Lecture 10, Etruscan Myths, Legends, and Heroes.
When the Etruscans came into direct and sustained contact with the Greeks in Italy, they began to adopt Greek gods and heroes, adding them into the Etruscan pantheon and decorating their houses, temples, and tombs with images and stories from Greek myth. In addition, the Etruscans used images of the Greek gods and myths to illustrate their own stories, which previously had no artistic versions, thereby confusing generations of archaeologists and art historians who followed long after them. My favorite example can be seen in the scene engraved on a bronze mirror that's owned by the Louvre. The scene is of two heroically nude men, that is, dressed only in flowing cloaks, armed with swords. One of the men kneels on an altar while he holds a small boy in his left hand and threatens him with the point of the sword. The boy reaches out with a pleading gesture to the other man who is approaching the altar. The iconography of the story allows us to recognize it from Greek art as an episode from a play by Euripides, in which King Telephus, the adult son of Hercules, is holding hostage Orestes, the infant son of Agamemnon, who is trying to rescue his son. Telephus was wounded by Achilles in a battle, and he took Orestes hostage to force Achilles to heal the wound, which the oracle of Apollo at Delphi indicated was the only cure for the injury. In return, Telephus will lead the Greeks to Troy, which they couldn't find on their own. It's a rare and complex story in Greek myth. The Louvre mirror is inscribed, however, and the characters are labeled with very different names. The Agamemnon figure is called Tasaeus. Orestes is labeled Pilonikos Tasaeoi Phil, and Telephus is called Lycurgus. The names are otherwise unknown, except that some scholars have concluded that Lycurgus might be an Etruscan version of Lycurgus, the king of Edonia, who killed his own son. In the absence of more information, scholars conclude that the Etruscans garbled two different Greek myths when they made the mirror. However, this strikes me as unlikely. The Etruscans had a very deep knowledge of Greek myth in the literary and artistic traditions. It's obvious that they knew not just the imagery, but the stories from Homer to the tragedians. I think instead, the artist used a standard scene of Greek myth, probably taken from a Greek vase, to illustrate an Etruscan story. The narrative elements of captivity and secret knowledge as revealed in a quest are prevalent in Etruscan myth, as we'll see. An alternative to the scholar's conclusion that the Etruscans were confused is that the scene is a mythological metaphor for a historical event. It's been argued that Tasaeus is Etruscan for or alludes to Tatius or Tatius, the Sabine king who marched on Rome to avenge the rape of the Sabine women. The Romans had kidnapped Tatius's daughter, as well as other young Sabine women, after which he led the Sabine army in an attack on Rome. That assault ended in a truce between the two people. So in this explanation, the two men personify their peoples, the Romans and Sabines. The example is important because the Etruscans repeatedly used images of Greek myth that the Greeks themselves never or rarely illustrated. I think the answer to the question of why Etruscan art quotes Greek myth is that the iconography of these stories sometimes conformed to the Etruscans' own myths, which they had not illustrated themselves. And so those well-known scenes were transferable. That means that variations from Greek myths were deliberate and meaningful as well. That strikes me as a far more useful approach than the more common assumption that such visual quotations represent mistakes on the parts of Etruscan artists. Let's give them some credit and also acknowledge that the Etruscans had myths and legends that were completely independent of Greek mythology. One such Etruscan myth involves Athropa, the goddess of fate. She appears as a beautiful winged woman with a wreathed head, wearing necklace and earrings, but generally otherwise nude. Unlike the Greek fates, the three sisters who apply the traditional female task of wool working to spinning, measuring, and cutting the thread of human life, Athropa carries a hammer and a nail. In Etruscan art, she's shown hammering the nail into the wall, symbolically marking the end of a life. This activity was replicated at Etruscan sanctuaries, with the annual ritual hammering a nail into the wall of a temple to mark the passage of another year. Athropa was an invisible spirit of fate. Sometimes she appears alongside the slain with the cause of their death, such as the head of a wild boar who killed a hunter. So not only did the Etruscans differ in their imagery of fate, their myths also reveal a different relationship to the earth than other Mediterranean people. Most religious revelations in ancient myth come from the sky, or are conveyed by someone who took them from the sky. In Greek myth, for example, Prometheus, who taught the Greeks how to sacrifice, brought fire down from Mount Olympus. The idea of religious wisdom coming up from the ground is very unusual and significant. One of the figures found repeatedly in Etruscan art illustrates the most important story in Etruscan mythology, the story of Tages. Now, Tages was the source for Etruscan knowledge of divination, and indeed of all religious ritual. In the story, someone, and in some versions it's Tarchon, the founder of the great Etruscan city of Tarquinia, is out plowing, and an infant pops out of a deep furrow. This infant has the features of an old man, such as wrinkles, teeth, and a bald head. He begins to speak, at which Tarchon cries out, and the tribes of Etruria gather. You'd think that plowing up an infant might be enough on its own to elicit cries of wonder, but I guess it was a different time. Anyway, Tages then dictates all of the divination practices and key religious rituals before either disappearing, dying, or being carried home by Tarchon. Versions of this story vary. In the latter version, Tarchon keeps Tages so that he can continue to inform the Etruscans and also reinforce the status and power of Tarchon, who, thanks to this information, becomes a priest and then a king. This is, of course, a great story, but what does it mean? Well, first, that Tarchon was plowing suggests that this was a time before the later onset of social stratification in ancient Etruria. The Roman tale of Cincinnatus plowing his own field prior to the Senate naming him dictator carries the same message of greatness being unconnected to wealth. Second, it validates the rule of Tarchon over the city. Owing to his mysterious advanced knowledge, which is based not on some leadership course, but on an adherence to the ritual requirements of the Etruscan gods. So that tells us something about Etruscan notions of kingship and the importance of the king's role as a priest in defining his worth for the position. And third, the distinction between the Etruscan myth and other Mediterranean earth myths is in what was brought forth from the earth. Other cultures told stories that their people came from the earth. The king of Athens, for example, claimed descent from a figure who came out of the ground on the Athenian Acropolis, Erichthonius, who was so closely associated with the earth that he had the lower half of a snake. This notion of autochthony, being born from the earth itself as a way of claiming connection to a place, is common in antiquity. The Etruscans alone claim autochthony for their rituals rather than themselves. And the story of Tages and Tarchon is not the only divination revelation in an Etruscan myth. Stories are also told of a female prophet, Lassa Vacuvia, who represents the curiously Etruscan form of equality, or at least symmetry, of paired male and female figures. Now, a number of winged female figures in Etruscan myth are called Lassa along with a second name. I think it's better thought of more of a title than a name. It might be translated spirit. Well, Lassa Vacuvia is said to have revealed her prophecies to Arens of Veltimnus, an Etruscan from Chiusi, a major Etruscan city in central Italy, located between Siena, Orvieto, and Arezzo. These prophecies were eventually recorded in about 90 BC by the Etruscan Haruspex, that is a priest specially trained in divination, Tarquitius. A section of the prophecy reads, "When Jupiter claimed the land of Etruria for himself, he decided and commanded the fields to be surveyed and the lands marked out. Knowing man and his worldly greed, he wanted the boundaries of everything to be marked by boundary stones. But if anyone touches or moves a boundary stone, extending his own possessions or diminishing those of someone else, for this crime, he will be condemned by the gods. The people responsible will be afflicted by the worst diseases and wounds, and their limbs will be weakened. Then even the land will be shaken by storms or whirlwinds and many landslips. The crops will be frequently laid low and cut down by rain and hail. They will perish in the heat of the summer. They will be killed off by blight. There will be civil strife amongst the people." Scholars connect this prophecy with Roman attacks on Etruria, and conclude that it's a threat by the Etruscans of divine wrath upon the Romans, who seized their land in the 4th to 2nd centuries BC. Maybe. There's a long tradition of circulating prophecies only after they appear to have been fulfilled. That may be the pattern here. Lest you think that the Etruscans just sat around wringing their hands at the injustice of Roman deprivations and waiting for the gods to smite them, think again. They also told stories of their own Etruscan heroes who stood up to the Romans, perhaps not in the contemporary period, but the distant past. They provided role models as well as inspiration for Etruscans under Roman power. Now, if the idea of a patriotically themed, nationally based hero seems unlikely to you, let me know. I'll send you a Captain America reading list. Captain America was a comic book hero created in 1940 in a deliberate attempt to galvanize U.S. opposition to Nazi Germany, and as an unsubtle way of saying which side the creators believed America should join in World War II. Captain America personified U.S. military might, and comic book tales about his adventures with his childhood friend and sidekick, Bucky Barnes, sold about 1 million issues a month for the duration of the war. Well, the Etruscans didn't have Captain America or even Captain Etruria. They did have the Vipinus brothers, specifically Aule and Caele Vipinus, referred to in Latin as Aulus and Caelius Vivenna. And the brothers seem to have had their share of adventures, some of which are told, which is one reason we know about them, by the Roman Emperor Claudius. Claudius, I should point out, wrote a 20-volume history of the Etruscans, the last such that we know from the ancient world. So I think we should conclude that he knew his subject. For example, in a speech before the Roman Senate, Claudius, who ruled from 41 to 54 AD, argued that the Senate should extend citizenship to the Gauls. In making his argument that non-Romans contributed to the Roman state and should be rewarded with citizenship, Claudius cites Caele Vipinus as his primary evidence. He tells the story of how Caele came to the aid of Servius Tullius, an Etruscan former slave whom Tanaquil prophesied should be king. Chile brought an army down from Etruria to support Servius, whose Etruscan name was Mastarna. Now, Chile and Aule are also both credited with aiding the final king of Rome, Tarquinius Superbus, in some vague but military way. A sign of just how heroic they are is the garbled chronology around them. Seriously, try to work out sometime how Hercules was able to act in all the stories told about him. You'll need an Excel spreadsheet, one entire wall of your bedroom, and the dates can't be reconciled, as they would require a lifespan generations long for Hercules. I mention the example of Hercules because another myth related by the Roman grammarian Varro has Chile and Aule fighting on the side of Romulus against the Sabine king Titus Tacius. This would make them about 250 years old by the time they came to the aid of Tarquinius Superbus. The brothers personify victorious Etruscan military intervention over the entire period of the kings in Rome. What did Tony Stark say to Captain America and Joss Whedon's The Avengers? "You're spry for an older fellow." And Cap was only 90 at the time. Well, Chile's brother Aule is also associated with a significant place name in Rome. A brief mention in one source lists him among the kings of Rome. And a very convoluted tradition related by Roman authors states that the Capitoline Hill itself was named for him. They argue that the name Capitoline is a corruption for Capit Auli, which is Latin for head of Aule or head of Aulus. An event in the expedition to aid Servius Tullius was found painted on the walls of an Etruscan tomb. A late 4th century BC tomb excavated outside the Etruscan city of Vulci is named the Francois Tomb for its excavator, and was decorated on its interior with an extraordinary series of wall paintings. The tomb is of a familiar form, carved out of solid rock with a passageway leading into an antechamber. Seven individual tomb chambers were carved off of the antechamber, three out of each side wall, and one out of the back wall directly opposite the entrance. The back wall, with its single central door, was the largest unbroken wall surface in the tomb, and since it faced the tomb entrance, it was the most visible and important space for decoration. The wall was painted with two scenes of bloodshed and carnage, each of which contained 10 figures. A Greek scene on the left, and an Etruscan one on the right. The Greek scene was the sacrifice of Trojan prisoners by Achilles at the culmination of the funeral games for Patroclus. Achilles is, on the wall painting, plunging a sword into one of the bound prisoners while the others wait to die. The artist added two Etruscan death demons, Vanth and Caru, to the Greek story on the left, perhaps incorporating the story into the Etruscan underworld structure. The right half of the back wall was purely Etruscan. A group of enemies from three different Etruscan cities has taken the Vipinus brothers and their allies prisoners. The painting shows their escape, their rescue, and their fight to freedom. It consisted of 10 figures, all standing in pairs, most heroically nude. The four pair on the right were locked in deadly hand-to-hand combat. In each pair, one combatant is stabbing his enemy to death with a sword. Although composed of pairs, all 10 are thought to belong to a single scene, balancing the 10 figures on the left. And the men are all identified by painted captions. From the left, Mastarna, the Etruscan name of Servius Tullius, with two swords under his left arm, frees the brother Chile Vipinus, whose hands are tied at the wrists. The next three pairs on the back wall are Larth Ulthus, Rosce, and the other brother, Aule Vipinus, who are killing Laris Papathnas, Velznak, Pesna, Archmisnas, Sevenak, and a fragmentary inscription of a name that starts with Venthakal and has a break, and then ends with Plasax. On the far right, the Etruscan Marque Commitlinus attacks but does not kill Naive Tarquinius Rumac, who seems to be pleading for mercy. What's going on here? We read the story this way. A group of enemies from three different Etruscan cities has taken Caile, Aule, Rosce, and Marque prisoner, but they're rescued by Larth Ulthes. We draw that conclusion because he's the only one among the Etruscans who's clothed and distributes swords to the captives, allowing them to fight their way out. The prisoners are shown killing their captors, while Mastarna, holding a sword for himself and one for Caile, cuts the latter's bonds. The names of the captors are unusually specific, since they include not only the typical two Etruscan personal names, but also the names of their cities. They come from Volsinii, which is modern Orvieto, Sovana, and Rome. In fact, the defeated figure on the right-hand wall is, in Latin, Gnaeus Tarquinius the Roman. These frescoes preserve the only visual record of a dramatic event, fictional or not, in the struggle by the Vipinus brothers against the sons of Tarquinius Priscus to put Mastarna, that is Servius Tullius, on the throne of Rome. I also think these paintings were designed to reinforce each other across the chamber. The sacrifice of the Trojan prisoners on the left reflects, in a distorted way perhaps, the deaths of the Vipinus brothers' captors. Perhaps both subjects were selected to serve sympathetically as blood sacrifices. The left and right walls contain pairs of struggling figures. On the left, Eteocles and Polynices, the sons of Oedipus, commit simultaneous fratricide in their civil war to rule Thebes. On the right, we have Marque Commitlinus and Naive Tarquinius, placed here perhaps as metaphorical brothers, or engaged in an Etruscan civil war, as they might have seen it. One additional story of the adventures of Aule and Caile seems to have historical roots. It's illustrated on an engraved bronze mirror and a series of cinerary urns from Cusi. A seer named Kaku is shown prophesizing, assisted by a young man named Artile, who sits by, prepared to record the prophecy. They're about to be seized by Aule and Caile Vipinus. Some scholars reconstruct the story this way. Aule and Caile have been pursuing Artile and have finally caught up with him as he's consulting with the seer Kaku. This is the sort of episode found in a number of myths. It's possible, however, that these scholars might be wrong. For one thing, the urns from Cusi show the Vipinus brothers leading away a bound Kaku while Artile sits on the ground, apparently despondent. That's hardly the expected iconography if they're there to grab Artile. There's another story that Marsyas, the king of the Marsi in Phrygia, which is modern Turkey, sent an envoy named Cacus, along with a companion, to Tarchon, the founder of Tarquinia. Tarchon, rather than giving the envoy the required immunity of a diplomat, had him seized and held captive. I think Artile is not the target here, but Cacus is. Why Tarchon wanted him held is never recorded, but it's possible that he has a more dire fate in mind than captivity. Some versions of the scene are flanked by vanths. Now, vanths are figures generally present at death to escort the souls of the deceased into the underworld. They may be there for the men on the ground who seem to be dead soldiers that have been guarding Kaku and Artile. But there are a number of stories in Greek and Roman myth where prominent men hold hostage seers or prophets in order to learn their own futures. In a later version, Virgil, in his Eclogue 6, has shepherds grab Silenus to learn the mysteries of the universe. What's notable in the context of the tales of the Vipinus brothers is, if I'm correct, that they're working for Tarchon of Tarquinia. That creates another connection between them and the Tarquinii, albeit a distant one. But it also adds another Etruscan city, in addition to Vulci and Rome, to the list of those that they're connected to. They're coming closer and closer to the Hercules level of national heroism. Here's the really exciting thing about the Vipinus brothers. Well, even more exciting than bloodshed. There's evidence that they were both real men once upon a time. Although they were thought to have come from Vulci, a cinerary urn inscribed with the name Arnth Caule Vipina was excavated from a necropolis outside the walls of Cusae. And from a sanctuary at Veii, excavators found an Etruscan vessel dated to the period from 600 to 550 BC, that is, contemporary with the traditional dates of Servius Tullius. And this vessel is inscribed Mene Mulavanthake Arvale Vipienus, which in English reads, Aule Vipinus dedicated me. Now, in addition to this material from Cusae and Veii, evidence of the stories is found at Rome, Vulci, Tarquinia, and Bolsena. Geographically, that means that physical evidence of the brothers covers virtually the entire area of Etruria, from Rome on its southern border, spreading north to Veii, Tarquinia, Vulci, Bolsena, and finally Cusae, over 100 miles from Rome. It seems that the Etruscans, as a people, took stories from the lives of historic Etruscans and embellished them into great, heroic, nationalistic myths, with themes of the Etruscans fighting on behalf of all Etruscans against, among other enemies, the Romans. The Vipinus brothers apparently personify Etruscan resistance to foreign invasion, and their stories illustrate the potential for all Etruscans to overthrow their enemies. They may not be unique as metaphorical representations of Etruscan military might. We also have the images of men standing on the seaside confronting a form of sea monster called the hippocampus, which always seems to be hovering above the waves facing them. Now, one interpretation of this scene argues that this sort of gigantic seahorse had to be confronted, overcome in battle, and then ridden to the afterlife on an island, a known element of Etruscan belief in the afterlife. Not all scholars agree. It's been suggested that the images of men fighting the hippocampus might be the only surviving imagery of otherwise lost Etruscan legends of heroes battling and defeating these monsters. After all, there are multiple images of these men, heroically and impossibly armed with multiple weapons, such as, my personal favorite, bow and spear. That does seem pretty heroic. I mean, seriously, if you can figure out how to wield a 6-foot spear in one hand and pull a bow with the other, you're my hero. The notion is that this motif is isolated from any accompanying myth because it serves as a mythological metaphor, certainly not unknown in Etruscan art and belief. In this case, the argument goes, the myth is a personified metaphor for heroic Etruscans on the shore holding back an onslaught from the sea. The hippocampus, in this interpretation, stands for the Greek fleet threatening Etruscan lands. The exclusive use of this motif in tombs, therefore, is to suggest that the deceased fulfilled the same role in life, perhaps as a soldier in an Etruscan army. The mix of myth and history is exactly what we find in the stories of the Vipinus brothers. It's a great idea. I love it. In terms of plausibility, it falls solidly into the maybe camp. Now, I've made a point of emphasizing the geographical distribution of evidence for the Vipinus brothers. The wide variety of media on which their evidence is found is even more significant. Fresco paintings, bronze mirrors, terracotta urns, religious votives, and even Roman literary references all help to build the stories of the Vipinus brothers throughout their lives and even including their deaths. According to the 3rd century AD Christian author Arnobius, everyone knows the story of how Aule Vipinus was killed, actually beheaded by his brother Slave, because of a crime against his fellow citizens, and was therefore denied burial in his fatherland of Etruria. And everyone knows how his head was buried at the top of the Capitoline Hill to ensure that the omen of the gods might be fulfilled. This is the omen that Rome was destined to rule the world, because when the final Etruscan ruler of Rome, Tarquinius Superbus, was preparing the foundations for the Temple of Jupiter, a human head rolled out. The head, caput in Latin, is the origin for the name of the Capitoline, and the association of it with Rome as caput, head of the world. All of this is really intriguing stuff for a number of reasons. First, it reinforces the Etruscan relationship to the temple, apparently built on this spot, partially to fulfill an omen. That is, in itself, a very Etruscan notion. Second, the head was of another Etruscan. Third, and perhaps most weird, this is only one of a number of Etruscan traditions of heads coming out of the ground to tell or fulfill omens. Apparently, Aule fulfilled that role in death, the final role played by this national hero.